Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 38 for Tuesday, February 23rd, 2010. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me are
Dominic Rodney
and Ben Snitkoff.
As usual, we have our three wonderful technology legal stories for you this week, including the Google Buzz lawsuit, which came out this week. I use Twitter. Please rob me. And can the feds search and seize files off of your computer if you use a peer-to-peer network? So diving in right to the first story, big news has come out in the last couple of weeks here. I think February 9th, Google announced and didn't even really announce when you signed into your Gmail account on that day. They presented you with a little pop-up notification letting you know about this little thing called Google Buzz, and a lot of people have been talking about it. It seems to approximate some functionality of Twitter whereby there are real-time streaming feeds that people can provide, and you can access it right through the Gmail interface. Right after this came out, though, a lot of people speculated that Google had just wandered into this crazy area with a bunch of privacy problems, namely because it wasn't a opt-in type of a program. Instead, it was more like an opt-out, meaning that you didn't really have any choice when you participated in Google Buzz, and all your email contacts and email addresses were shared with the rest of your contacts in Gmail. And not only that, the contacts of your contacts were also shared with everybody else, and sort of it had sort of this strange, almost like a Kevin Bacon connection with all of your contact information, and it automatically subscribed people to certain feeds, and it allowed people to see who other people's most contacted people are through their Gmail accounts. And everyone wasn't really sure what to make of it. In fact, Ben and I had appeared on another podcast called This Week in Law the other week, and this is days after Google Buzz came out, and we couldn't really, in that span of 2 days, come up with any recognizable legal actions against Google for it. But sure enough, just a few days later, now we have a lawsuit. And this stems from a woman who is a Florida resident, and I've kind of read conflicting stories about this. It might be that she is a second-year law student at Harvard Law School. In any event, her name is Eva Hibnick, and she sued Google this week based on a number of causes of actions, all which sort of deal with disclosure of private information or disclosure of electronic information, and she also sued under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and some California common law torts like disclosure of private facts. So just to kick us off here, do you guys want to add anything?
I do want to point out, she is technically the complaint calls her a citizen of Florida, but everything I've heard does say that she's a law student at Harvard Law in Cambridge. So, you know, while she may still be registered to vote and, you know, her driver's license may be from Florida, she's currently living in Boston.
Right. So initially, I mean, did you guys have any thoughts that you wanted to throw into about what Google Buzz is and how it might otherwise implicate privacy concerns?
Well, it seems like, and it did tell you what it was when you, and if you read very carefully, it did say you're going to reveal everything publicly. And when I signed up, I read it carefully, saw that, and immediately clicked through and changed my settings on my contact lists so that it wouldn't be public to everyone who I'm following. So there was a disclaimer, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right. I think the problem is, and this is also in the complaint, even if you read the disclaimer and, you know, click through that says, I don't want to go to Buzz right now, Buzz still was activated and all this stuff would still happen. So yes, it did explain, you know, carefully, or maybe not carefully enough, depending on your point of view, what was going to happen. There was no, at least on its face, there was no way to stop it from happening, which it seems like it posed a problem, if nothing else.
I mean, clearly to me, I remember signing in that morning and seeing this little notification pop up, and I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was like, here's Google Buzz! And I was like, well, what the hell is this? And so I clicked through it just to see what it was, and lo and behold, as I did that, you know, everything seemed to be shared with everybody else right then. So I didn't really feel, at least in that particular instance, that there was full and fair disclosure about exactly what the service was going to do or what it was. And that seemed to be, well, part at least of the concerns of the plaintiff in this case. And she has indicated that she wants to make this a class action lawsuit for all of the 37 million Gmail users across the United States. And in particular, the statutes that she is claiming that Google violated include the Electronic Communications Act, the Stored Communications Act. Both of those deal with basically disclosure of electronic information and whether or not somebody who is holding electronic information can do that or can disclose it without certain types of authorizations. And one of the more interesting ones that I found was the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And as we've covered before in the show, that particular statute tends to cover when somebody has exceeded authorized access or they've accessed a computer system without authorization. And it has both criminal and civil components to it. What do you guys make of a case based on either exceeding authorized access to a person's computer or accessing it without authorization in the case of Google Buzz? Because the interesting thing here, it seems to be that, well, when you sign up, if you do have a Google account, you signed up and you agreed to their privacy policies and their terms of service agreement, and so you've basically subjected yourself to those terms, and as usual, within a lot of the terms of service agreements, those terms can change from time to time, not necessarily with notification to you. Is there any way that you could see that Google might have exceeded authorized access?
Not that I could put a finger on. It seems like everything that's happening is on Google's own computers, which certainly wouldn't be exceeding authorized access to, you know, another's computer. It does say that, you know, they plead this count in the alternative, that they either authorized, either intentionally accessed a protected computer without authorization, or knowingly caused the transmission of information resulting in the loss to one or more persons, resulting in a loss to one or more persons in violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Now, I don't really know what that loss would be. Usually, at least in this case, you'd think it would have to be some sort of pecuniary loss, you know. Either somebody would have to take some sort of measures to have, you know, remedied this, in which case, you know, that would really be on a person-by-person basis, or, you know, you'd have to be able to prove some sort of physical harm that came to you because of this, and I think that's going to be tough to prove. So, you know, they may not have to prove that they authorized a computer... that they accessed a computer without authorization or exceeded it. They may, you know, try to proceed on this knowingly caused the transmission count, but I don't, from the complaint, I don't really see what that loss is.
So I sat down and I tried to think about some of the ways in which they might be able to find a violation of the CFAA, and when you go through the Google privacy policy, which you can locate just down at the bottom of the Google page, it's first of all, Google does this great thing where they try to summarize their privacy policy, and then you have to click through a bunch of hyperlinks in order to get to the actual policy itself, you know, beyond just the summary of what exactly their privacy policies are. And I found out that the current privacy policy they have appears to be the same one that they placed a year ago, meaning the last modifications they implemented to it were back in March of 2009. And they define personal information in the privacy policy as any information which personally identifies you, such as your name, email address, billing information, or any other data which may be able to, which someone could use to identify you with. And within the privacy policy, then they go on to say there's this little section about information sharing, and it says here that Google only shares personal information with other companies or individuals outside of Google in the following circumstances, and they bullet point these three circumstances here, and it includes when they have your consent, or when we provide such information to our subsidiaries for limited purposes that it would only be in compliance with this privacy policy for the purpose of processing personal information, and so basically, that's just done in very limited circumstances. And when they have a good faith belief that access, use, preservation, or disclosure of such information is reasonably necessary for any applicable laws, regulations, or legal processes, that's a pretty standard term right there, to enforce the applicable terms of service, so meaning if there was some other reason under the terms of service they would need to disclose your information, or to detect, prevent, or otherwise address fraud, security, or technical issues. So based on that it seems that the privacy policy pretty much limits the circumstances in which they can share something like your email address with other people. Notwithstanding that, though, the buzz seemed to kind of conflict directly with those principles, or if you want to call it a contract, this particular policy that they have in place. So based on that, I think you could say that you're exceeding some form of authorized access. I don't know if that's enough to satisfy the requirements of the suit itself, or for the act itself, but I guess you could articulate an argument that you're exceeding some form of authorized access when you're doling out that information to others.
I'm just not seeing the electronic communication, the Privacy Act violation or the CFAA violation, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violation. I just am not seeing it because this is all on Google servers. You gave them this data, and Buzz does tell you that it's going to be publicly disclosed. If you don't read that, again, you could immediately, upon setting up Buzz, go and change your privacy settings right away, and you would be completely... You wouldn't have your follower list shared with the world. So, as for the public disclosure aspect, I think that's probably going to be their strongest case in that, well, gosh, most users aren't going to go into the settings immediately and change the privacy levels so that their follower lists aren't public, because most users don't have any idea that that's how this thing works. I'm not seeing the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Electronic Communication Privacy Act, because there's no privileged computers in this sense. It's all on Google servers.
Ben? I don't know if there's enough here in this complaint to really get it past, you know, what would be a motion to dismiss on the pleading. They allege all the facts that are, you know, known publicly, that Google released this, what happens, you know, they talked about Google walking back on the privacy concerns, but when it comes to the actual counts, you know, to read one of them for you, it's by engaging in the foregoing acts and omissions, the defendant Google intentionally and without authorization divulged electronic communications in violation of the act. That doesn't, as you know, as Google, I would argue that that does not give me enough notice as to, you know, what it is I'm supposed to be defending here. Even if it does get dismissed, though, you know, the plaintiff would probably get a chance to refile, but it seems unnecessarily brief. It doesn't really feel like the attorneys here sussed out what they were going for.
Well, as we talked about pleading standards and probably as we talked about before, I mean, the pleading standards are pretty light, I think, and so you don't necessarily, I mean, you have to support allegations that particular statutes for civil liability have been violated and back that up with facts. You're right, they certainly didn't go into detail about how exactly those particular acts might apply, but I guess in terms of a motion to dismiss, should one be filed by Google, I would suspect that they would file one. I don't know that they have pleaded enough just on the wording of their complaint in order to satisfy that there have actually been violations, or at least violations sufficient enough to go on to the discovery phase of the litigation. But you brought up a great point, Dominic, and that's this one of the last two counts that they pleaded in the complaint has to deal with this common law tort under California law, which is disclosure of private facts. How is that implicated here through Google Buzz, and what do you guys think about whether or not this case might be successful?
You log into your Gmail account, Buzz turns itself on. Regardless of whatever you pick, whether you say go to Buzz now or just go to my inbox, it turns itself on. And then until you go to your privacy settings and change your follower list to private instead of public, it's been publicly disclosed. Basically it defaults to on. And until you get to that control panel and change that option, it's on. So even for someone who wants it off right away and is aware of how to change it, it's going to be public for a good 20 seconds at least until you click over to the control panel. So at minimum, there's that disclosure. If someone is very carefully stalking you, waiting for you to log on to Google Buzz, they'll get those 20 seconds and see your follower list, whether or not you wanted it, no matter what you do in terms of trying to make it private. This is as it was. Obviously, Google has changed things now, but we're talking about the way it was at the start.
Something I hadn't really followed very closely was that, so everyone was really upset about this feature, how it just sort of pushed out all of your personal information to all the other contacts. Google did sort of step back a little bit. They issued something akin to an apology on their blog, on the Gmail blog, I think, and I believe they made it easier to manage privacy settings. I don't know what the settings were actually on the date of release or the day after the day of release before they had rolled out those changes. Are either of you guys familiar?
No, I didn't follow exactly what the changes were. I disabled Buzz before this entire thing blew up.
It could work, I guess. It seemed like people were saying that you couldn't easily opt out of it, and the problem was really the fact that it just automatically opted you in rather than giving you the option to opt in, which, you know, Facebook has run into problems with opt-in versus opt-outs before with the Beacon program that they had. So this is kind of similar to that in that sense, but at least they seem to have changed the settings enough now where you can manage your privacy a little bit better. It still might be the case, though, that it was too little, too late kind of thing, where even though they stepped back and changed the ability of a person to manage those settings, there still might have been a period of time where there were, you know, where those settings were not manageable to the extent that you could possibly have colorable causes of action under these statutes. It's kind of hard to say, though. I do think, though, that the you know, the public disclosure of private facts might be one of the more stronger arguments on the merits of the pleading itself. Another thing that sort of popped up that we talked briefly on This Week in Law was that there was a person, and it might even be the person that was involved in this case, I can't remember, who hadn't even created a Google account at all, but still had her information shared on it, so it didn't give her a quick and easy way to opt out. And apparently she had some sort of abusive ex-boyfriend, and among all the people which this information was shared to on Buzz, and it's not really even clear to me exactly how she was then put into the Buzz program, whether she was using some other type of Google service which opted her into Buzz or however that happened. But this information was apparently shared with the abusive ex-boyfriend, and among all of the contacts that were shared to this person, it included her current boyfriend, because he was one of the more an individual who was getting frequent emails from her. And that seems to be like a scenario where you might not have agreed to some of the policies on Google's terms of service because you didn't actually create an account, but at the same time, then you still have all your personal information being shared to a person that you never wanted it to be shared with. So, again, I guess it's going to be a little bit fact-dependent here. I don't know. This probably still hasn't been certified as a class this early. So it's even though it's been filed as a class action and all the news sites are reporting it to be a class action, I believe it will still have to be certified as a class in the court itself before it can go forward as a class action. Any other thoughts before we move on to our next story?
I'm all set. Dominic?
All set, except for it's interesting to note that Google actually used Buzz internally for several months before they launched it. So.
Interesting. Interesting to see that they didn't foresee some of these problems or the backlash. Moving on to our next story, which is another one which involves other privacy information. There is a group out there called For the Hack, and they have created a website, which is pleaserobme.com, which is apparently aggregating people's tweets and postings on Foursquare. And whenever they post something that says that they're basically out of their house, it takes their little tweet or their post on Foursquare, and it publishes them to a list which is accessible, and this is still up as of today. We're recording on Monday. It posts them to a list that says, people who are not home, please rob me. And the idea is to, apparently, by using information location tools, or if you have a mobile device, or if you're using an online service which posts your location as you're making like a post or a tweet, it is basically saying that this person is no longer at their home. Why don't you go ahead and rob them? And the idea, apparently, based on the wording of the site itself, is to bring attention to the fact that some information location tools are dangerous in terms of the information that you're providing to them. So did you guys have any other thoughts on this story?
Well, my first thought is that, and Foursquare responded to this, they said, you know, our default is to not publish to Twitter and Facebook, and in fact, we ask you every time that you check in whether or not you want to publish this to Twitter and Facebook. So it's not like Foursquare is divulging this information automatically to, a public Twitter feed. And there are a couple of things you can do. One, you can choose not to publish to Twitter. Right now, the default for Foursquare is to publish only to people who you friended on Foursquare. And the second thing is, even if you do publish to Twitter, you can always have a protected feed, which means you're not publishing to the public stream, and therefore it's not open for everyone that you're going to be that you're out of the out of your house.
So I think one of the concerning things, just from a legal standpoint, hypothetically, if someone created a service like this and came to one of you guys looking for legal counsel, could you foresee any types of criminal liability that might stem from something like this?
A service like Twitter or a service like Please Rob Me?
A service like Please Rob Me.
You're going to have a tough time proving that. They're republishing public information. They're aggregating it in one place. And, you know, I guess you could proceed on two theories here. The criminal theory, which is that, you know, they're somehow aiding and abetting a criminal, but that's not going to fly. You need to prove something other than, you know, re-aggregating information. There's got to be some sort of material support. And if this information is already out there, I mean, they're not providing an actual address of the people, just their Twitter handle, so there's still a lot of work that a criminal would have to do. On the civil side, generally, I mean, if you're proceeding from a view of negligence, generally a person won't be liable for an intervening criminal act of a third party.
Looking at the site, they do actually provide addresses. I'm not sure whether those are the addresses where the people are or where their homes are, though.
Oh, like where it says, Jamie, I'm looking at it right now, you know, somebody I'm left home
Starbucks.
And checked in at DeVry. Yeah, that's where they're currently checked in on Foursquare. That's not their home.
Okay.
I mean, that being said,
wouldn't be hard to look at their Twitter history and see when they tweeted from home, where they were.
Yeah, or, you know, this guy's from Cincinnati. How many Jamie Asquiths are there in Cincinnati, and figure it out from there.
Yeah, right. So, but suppose you had a case where someone was using their actual name on one of these services. And so, for instance, someone who's using Ben Snickoff. We'll say it was you, Ben. And since you, I'm always the butt end of all your hypotheses. So I'm turning the table on you this time. And so let's say that you were using the service and you were using your actual name on the service. And not only that, you're also listed in either a phone book or something else, which not only includes your phone number, but your address. And let's say that some nefarious criminal then sees that you are out and about on the town in Boston, you're sipping some lovely Starbucks, you know, way far away from where your home is, and then just does a little bit of research and determines, oh, okay, well, Ben lives at such and such address, so I'm going to go over there and see if I can get into his place, and successfully does so, robs you of your prized Apple computers, and walks away with it. If, you know, in this odd circumstance, if this guy eventually does get caught, there's no way, is what you're telling me, that a website like Please Rob Me could then be held criminally liable under those circumstances for somehow encouraging somebody to go out and rob someone's home.
I'm not going to say absolutely no way, but they're certainly not going to be liable as like a joint venturer. They're not going to be liable, you know, as a primary or a secondary actor here. You know, maybe there's some weird law that makes it a crime to republish information that could lead to a burglary. But I mean, if you're getting that deep into a law like that, and there's a chance that something like that would violate, you know, First Amendment rights of publishing publicly available information. I absolutely cannot see a way that these people would be held criminally liable for somebody else robbing my house.
I mean, to do a sort of non-tech example, say that you're a famous actor and your private residence is well known, and a newspaper publishes, famous actor will be attending the Oscars tonight. That's basically the same thing, saying, hey, he's not going to be home. This is just the same thing on a much larger scale, but the scale doesn't
change the... but the domain name, the domain...
PleaseRobMe.com.
PleaseRobMe.com. I mean, it's basically saying, go ahead and go rob this person. It's okay.
I mean, is your argument that this, going to like a Brandenburg test, that this is inciting somebody to imminent illegal activity? Because that's the kind of thing that you need to go after them. I'd argue that's exactly the standard, now that I think about it, that you'd have to apply as to whether or not you could even prosecute these people criminally.
And it's worth saying on their site, they do say that our intention is not and never has been to have people burgled.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely not going to meet the incitement or imminent illegal activity parts of... You're basically not going to meet any part of this test except for the illegal activity. You know, there's nothing on here that's, you know, advocating that people immediately rob. I mean, other than the title, which is tenuous at best. And, you know, the illegal activity that's the subject of that has to be imminent. Like, it's hard to, you know, really define that test, but... You have to be standing, you know, a prime example would be like standing in the town square and being, go over there and cut down that public tree. That would be inciting people to imminent illegal activity. But this just is not.
I think that if I'm recalling criminal standards correctly, and I've never been a criminal attorney and I absolutely have zero expertise in the matter, but if I remember...
Stop
what
talking
I did,
yourself up, Dave, really. Enough of this self-aggrandizing.
If I do remember the small amount of criminal law that I picked up in law school, I think that the standards for accomplice liability require more than just mere knowledge of the fact that somebody will take... information as encouragement. I think you really have to be more of a willing participant in a crime. And based on this little disclosure that's on the, you know, the front page of their website that says that, hey, we're not actually telling you to go out and burglar houses or homes. You know, this is more about raising awareness of privacy implications of providing, you know, real time information about where you are. That probably goes in their favor.
That's true for accomplice liability. I'm curious whether they might. I mean, solicitation saying that go forth and commit crimes, but they explicitly say don't go forth and commit a crime. So I guess I don't see solicitation either.
And yeah. Maybe through all of this, they've just gotten the coverage that they wanted to get, because as far as I've read here, and it's even posted on their site, they've been covered by, you know, Forbes and CNET and Mashable and a bunch of other news sites with people reporting on this website, and I think that they did have a Twitter account, and so they're actually retweeting all these things or something along those lines, and I think that was actually shut down for suspicious activity. I don't know if it was reinstated or not, but you know, they have at least raised awareness because people are reporting on it, and maybe people will then take heed to, you know, the exactly what they're trying to raise here.
Yeah, I'm not positive about this. My guess is the suspicious activity would have been the fact that, you know, they're republishing, you know, hundreds of these Foursquare check-ins a minute. So that's my guess is that would be what was suspicious about it, the sheer volume that they were retweeting.
Any other ways in which you think that people could try to stop them from retweeting these types of things, or not just retweeting, but
yeah, don't publish your Foursquare things to Twitter. It's a good way.
This is another one of those kind of, if you don't like something being public, then don't make it public.
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit, I use Foursquare, and in a while, several months now of using Foursquare, I've publicly tweeted one check-in because I was in North Carolina and I had the most amazing ribs ever. I wanted everybody to know exactly where that was.
Incidentally, Google Buzz, if you use the mobile client, publishes your location.
Yes, it does. And it shows you locations of people using Buzz, the mobile Buzz client, who are near you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or the same place in previous time. So, like, what did someone say here a day ago?
Yeah, so, any thoughts on whether or not we might see, like, a crazy copyright claim come out of this?
A copyright claim for the tweets?
Sure. Yeah, so they're, I'm looking at here, and it seems that in at least some of these postings that are streaming here under recent empty homes, they're basically republishing tweets that people have posted to their Twitter account.
Maybe it's a tough call because the vast majority of these are entirely factual. You know, somebody left home and they're checking in. You know, the check-in says I'm at, Petco in Fargo. People can also do little blurbs. Like one of these says mani-pedi massage. Ah, relax. It's tough to make a copyright claim on those. You know, five words.
That's true, and it would, well, I mean, they are taking every, it seems like they're taking the entire tweet in whole here as they redo them, but maybe there's some argument that there's implicit authorization to be retweeted or republished somewhere else with some of your tweets.
Yeah, or at the very least that what's the word, transformative, that they're taking this information and they're repurposing it to prove a point about privacy. It's one of the weaker transformative arguments, but, you know, courts have been buying more and more transformative arguments recently, so I'll throw it out there.
Well, in any event, I'll be interested to see if any lawsuits come out of this or if any of the federal agencies or local authorities have any interest in what these guys are trying to do here. Any final thoughts before we move on to our last story?
I'm all set. Dominic?
All set.
So our last story involves peer-to-peer networks and the ability of the feds to search and seize files on your computer, or at least so it purports to be. I read the story off of Wired. I don't know if you guys caught it, but Wired had reported with the headline that the feds can go in and search and seize files off of your peer-to-peer networks. And you know, I thought that was pretty interesting, but then as I went in and actually read the decision, which is became the basis of that particular news post, I kind of thought that it was a little bit misleading. I don't know what you guys thought.
What? Wired Threat Level had a title on a post that was misleading?
That never happens, and we never report about that on our blog either.
Yes, the vast majority of our DFUD articles don't come from Wired's Threat Level blog.
Sir, is dripping onto the floor.
Yeah, sorry, we're all a little jaded this week for whatever reason. Essentially, if I can recap this, what happened was a guy was using LimeWire and had child pornography in his shared folder. His argument was that one, the federal government should have to have a warrant to go through and search your shared folder, and secondly, he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in his shared folder because he thought he had disabled his share folder on LimeWire. And the court basically disagreed with both of those, saying if you're sharing it with the entire internet, the government doesn't need a warrant to go in and look for it. And secondly, just because you thought that you disabled it doesn't mean you disabled it, and it doesn't mean that you or society has a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. And, you know, that's a common fallacy that people make when dealing with Fourth Amendment things, and we talked about this a little last week. You know, whether or not you reasonably expected it to be private is different from whether or not society, or in, you know, a legal realist point of view, whether or not the court believes that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in whatever it is that was searched.
Right. So in this case, as you noted, it was all about child pornography, and this was a criminal action, and the defendant in the case was using LimeWire, right? And he had, at least it was said in the, or at least the court noted in the decision that came out of it, that the defendant had purchased and downloaded a particular version of LimeWire, this peer-to-peer software, and within it, he apparently had the ability to not show file names that were being held in his shared folder, and he also had the ability to stop sharing those files outwardly to the world. But apparently, according to the defendant, he rebooted his computer and magically all of the settings in LimeWire went back to default, and that included re-enabling file sharing. And so some sort of federal agent, was probably a federal FBI agent, was conducting searches on LimeWire and was able to identify a couple of files, which using some government software or maybe publicly available software, he was able to determine that the images were in fact known child pornography, and then was able to make the association between those files and the defendant's account, and then After that, and this was sort of the twist that really got me and made me think that the Wired blog just had exaggerated the case in general, was that then the agent went out after downloading the files and verifying that they were in fact child pornography or known child pornography, went out and got a search warrant and then seized the computer itself. And it was really more about the agent's ability to search on LimeWire and while conducting an investigation. It just strikes me as so odd that the Wired would make a big deal about that, because whenever you're using a peer-to-peer sharing service like that, I mean, you're basically offering those files in your shared folder out to the world. So it seems very akin to sort of the in plain view doctrine, that, you know, the circumstance where a police officer might walk by you and catch you committing some sort of crime and then be like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and seize this evidence. But in this circumstance, it was all about the search query and managing the hash data which was associated with those files, and then going ahead and getting the warrant before going into his home and searching or seizing the computer itself and finding, you know, a bunch of child pornography on it.
One of the things about the in plain view of doctrine is it requires the officer to be legitimately on the premises. I guess his argument here is the officer shouldn't be on LimeWire looking around for him. That I guess if you did take his argument at face value, if you feel that the government shouldn't be on LimeWire, then anything on LimeWire shouldn't be available to the government. That's a really weak argument because it's available to everyone else who looks for it. Why shouldn't it be to the government? It's basically public. But that essentially seems to be his argument, as far as I can tell.
Right. That and, oh, I didn't know the settings were set like this.
All right, well, stupidity is no defense in the law, so...
Yeah, it never really has been, and you know, the fact that just because you thought that your settings were a particular way doesn't really afford you the expectation of privacy, which might prevent searches in those instances, especially when it's online too, and things are easily searchable. It sounds like what this guy might have been doing, giving him sort of the best inference of the facts, was that he was using this, he was using LimeWire to manage his files, basically, and that's why they were in there. It was all about using the LimeWire interface to manage his stuff. He didn't actually intend to be sharing them out to the world, but lo and behold, he was.
The LimeWire interface is terrible. Anyway.
Right. So, an interesting story by Wired, but sort of an uninteresting holding. I don't know of any law that actually speaks contrary. Are you aware of any, Ben, that might give you some form of protection and terms of privacy, if where you thought that you had a reasonable expectation of privacy, but actually didn't?
No, the court got it right here. I mean, we're not going to prevent undercover officers from, you know, buying drugs on the street to catch drug dealers. Likewise, we're not going to prevent FBI agents from going on LimeWire to catch people who are sharing child pornography. It's just not a meritorious argument.
Well, on that note, maybe we can end this week a tiny bit early, unless you guys have any other thoughts that you wanted to bring up about this case.
No, I'm all set.
All set.
Okay, well, thanks for tuning in again to the Technically Legal Podcast. I was your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me...
Dominic Rybia.
And Ben Snitkoff.
Please be sure to check out our website and blog at technicallylegal.org. You can send us comments at podcast@technicallylegal.org. And check out our Twitter stream at @techlegal. We'll see you again next week.
It's vodka. It means little water.